I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're covering The State versus Fred Freeman, episodes 1 and 2. If you haven't yet listened to those episodes, stop listening to this right now. Go back and listen to episodes 1 and 2, and then come back and listen to this. We will be here when you get back. Joining me to talk about what we've learned so far about this case is Colin Miller. He's an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law and one of the hosts of Undisclosed and my favorite legal series. Hello, Colin.
Hey, Rebecca. How are you?
I'm great. How are you holding up these days, Colin? You doing okay?
Yeah, we just wrapped up classes for the semester, so everything went okay, relatively speaking.
I'm glad to hear it. Also with us is Dave Sanders. He's on the board of directors of Proving Innocence. That's a private nonprofit organization dedicated to freeing people wrongfully convicted and wholly innocent. In his previous life, he was director of Metropolitan Affairs Coalition. Dave has worked intimately on the Temujin Kensu case for more than 10 years. Hello, Dave.
Hey, nice to be here.
How are you holding up these days?
So far, I'm not sick, don't have a fever or a cough.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. Everyone's healthy so far. And finally with us is Herb Welser. He's a private investigator working on this case. Before that, he spent 30 years with the Michigan PD. Hello, Herb. How are you?
Good, Rebecca. How are you?
Good. I have a lot of questions about this case, but first I'm going to just provide a quick summary to catch our listeners up to some details they may have forgotten about. So here we go with that. In episode 1 of The State versus Fred Freeman, the Undisclosed team introduced us to the case of Fred Freeman, who was convicted of the 1986 murder of community college student Scott Macklem in Port Huron, Michigan, in the Lower Peninsula. The episode focused on Freeman's numerous alibi witnesses, placing Freeman and Escanaba in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan hours before and after the murder. In episode 2, the team focused on 3 eyewitnesses to the murder, 1 who was hypnotized, and 2 who were shown a very suggestive photo array. Finally, the episode concludes by laying out the state's closing theory at trial that Freeman could have chartered a private plane that could have taken him to and from Port Huron in time to commit the murder. So the first thing I just want to clear up, if listeners are confused, Fred Freeman did change his name to Temujin Kensu. Dave, when did he change his name? Can you just talk about that a little bit so listeners can just be familiar with why that name change happened?
Oh, I guess it must be, he's used that name for, I think, 8 or 10 years, actually. He studied religious, you know, studies for, he's had religious studies for the longest time, very bright guy, and he just got very interested in Buddhism, but then recently he's basically come around to Christianity.
Hmm. Okay, so we'll probably use his names, both names, because, you know, it can be confusing because at the time he was Freeman and that's sort of how he's referred to in that timeline.
All his court records are Freeman too, so.
Yes. Okay, good, good. I just want to make sure that people understand that I'm, you know, not trying to ignore the name change if we use them interchangeably. So I do have a question for you, both Dave and Herb, and this is something that I wonder about when I talk to people who have been working on a wrongful conviction for a long time. What is that like to be so involved with a case for so long? Dave, I'm going to start with you. What has this experience been like for you, you know, working on this for such a long time?
Well, in one word, I'd say frustrating because, you know, it's so difficult to get a wrongfully convicted person out. You know, it's really been, you know, a little more than 10 years ago, an investigative reporter for WXYZ TV in Detroit wanted to form a nonprofit that would work on wrongful conviction. And I had just retired as an urban planner and had experience running nonprofits. So I volunteered along with several others and we formed this Proving Innocence organization. And, you know, we primarily raised money to hire professional investigators to develop evidence of innocence. And we also primarily take cases from the Michigan Innocence Clinic at the University of Michigan's Law School. So we have some confidence that the prisoners actual innocence. They vet it, and then we'll take on that case. And I've primarily devoted, as I said, for the last 10 years, been devoted to Fred's case, you know, which is just so terribly bad and unjust and fascinating, unbelievable. And so I was intrigued. But also, at about that same time, his wife had died of cancer. So he's kind of left alone. So we have a real miscarriage of justice here. And I thought I could do something meaningful besides playing golf all day and work on a case like Stellingen's. And it's almost become full time for me.
Now, Herb, as we hear in the episode in which you appear, you worked for the Port Huron Police Department for 30 years before working on this case. What has that been like for you? I mean, does it feel like switching sides? How did you make that transition?
Well, when I retired from the police department in 2005, I had absolutely no idea that I would ever become involved in something like this. Even criminal defense work, some of the attorneys that knew me well in Port Huron had asked me if I would be willing to do some criminal defense work for them. And I felt uncomfortable because this is not a large community, it's a smaller community. The police officers, all in this area, I knew them. We had a good working relationship. So that's how I just wanted to start out by letting you know that this isn't something I went and seeking for to get involved in this case. And I can go into the reason here in a few minutes if you'd like me to.
I would love to hear that. Yeah.
So after I retired in 2005, the first couple of years as a private investigator, most of my work was for attorneys on personal injury and wrongful death. And in 2007, I was here at home listening to the local Port Huron radio station, and I heard Bill Proctor talking about this case. And I was actually working the day that the murder occurred. I was traffic safety officer, and I was in the office, and I remember hearing the radio traffic about someone that had been injured in the St. Clair County Community College parking lot. But I was in no way involved in this investigation, either then or throughout the years. The last 3 years I was with the police department, I was detective lieutenant. And during that time, I didn't look into anything about this case, but I would read about it in the local Times Herald newspaper. And of course, it was interesting, the things I was reading about it, but I wasn't involved in it. So I didn't get involved in it until there was something that Bill Proctor said that, in my own mind, conflicted with what I had heard in the office the day of the murder. And so I reached out to Bill Proctor and asked him if he would be interested that I would like to look at some documents in police reports, things like that about this case. So he made contact with, and I'll be referring to Fred, that's how I usually always refer to him as Fred. Bill Proctor reached out to Fred's wife, Amico, who made contact with me, and she came to my home and started bringing me documents. And for the first couple of months, I figured that, hey, this is probably just another guilty person in prison. That's trying to get out. But the more that I kept reading documents and police reports, the more red flags kept coming up. And this is 13 years later, and I've interviewed many, many people, put in hundreds and hundreds of hours on my own time. I've never been paid a penny for this case because I really believe it's the right thing to do. But after a couple of months of reading these documents and police report, that's when I started investigating this. And there's no doubt in my mind that he's innocent. And it's to go back to your question about how is this with me, previously working for the Port Huron Police Department. The Port Huron Police Department was wonderful to me. I had a wonderful career there. The city of Port Huron was great to me. But when I became convinced that Fred Freeman was innocent, I felt that even though this is the police department that I retired from, I just can't walk away from this. You know, I have to do the right thing.
What about you, Colin? How did this case end up on your radar?
Yeah, so as you know, we've worked with the Philadelphia Conviction Integrity Unit on a number of cases, some that have led to exonerations. And so I read an article last fall or winter about the formation of a statewide conviction integrity unit in the state of Michigan. And it mentioned this case as being one that they'd be filing for relief before the conviction integrity unit. And I started reading about the case, and I think, as Herb mentioned, you start to see all these alibi witnesses and this crazy plane theory we presented in episode two. And so I wanted to learn more about the case and reached out to Mr. Freeman's attorney and reached out to the CIU and got some good responses from them. And so decided to take it on and dig deeper into the issues.
Now, Colin, this might be the case. I mean, I have produced most of the episodes of Undisclosed, most of the cases you've covered. I don't remember there ever being a case where there were this many corroborating witnesses for the defense, both at the crime scene and alibi witnesses that proved that the person was not at the crime scene. I mean, can you think of a situation where you've had so many people who were there, you know, saw a suspect, heard gunshots? You know, so the time of the crime is nailed down. Mm-hmm. And then the timing of the alibi is also nailed down with all of these corroborating witnesses, the karate studio people, the kids on the street. I can't think of a case where there have been this many witnesses contradicting the state's theory before.
Yeah. And I think as both Dave and Herb have pointed out to me, and as you can see from episode one, you know, some of these witnesses are friends or his fiance, Michelle. But, you know, the people at the karate studio don't really know him that well. And in fact, the one starting to being a nurse has a pretty unfavorable opinion. Yeah. And so, you know, these are not close friends or family who are providing a lot of the alibis. And also they have reasons to corroborate the alibis. They can pinpoint this particular Wednesday in November 1986. That's the day he visited the karate studio. So it's not just the number, which of course you point out, but it's also the quality of these alibi witnesses. They're much stronger than the traditional alibi witness you might see.
Right, because the people at the campus, they were there for a reason, and that reason had as a schedule attached to it, you know, a seminar or a class. And then the karate studio people also have a schedule attached to their accounts because, you know, one of them had just finished teaching a class, which is always at the same time. I have another question for you, Colin, and this doesn't come up in the podcast, but I found myself thinking it, and I'm sure others were too. Did the fact that Fred Freeman had both a fiance and was seeing someone on the side play into his initial, you know, interactions with the police? Was he at all invested in kind of keeping that side relationship secret, and that maybe didn't help him when he was first having contact with the police and laying out this timeline?
Not, you know, Herb or Dave might have more insight to that. I haven't played the audio yet, but I did discuss this issue with Fred in one of our interviews. And he said he was, you know, quite open at the time that he was not a one-woman man. And, you know, Michelle knew about this, and he was kind of Lothario back then and was seeing a bunch of women at the time. So I don't think that played a role. But Herb or Dave, are you aware of sort of...
I wouldn't say it played a role, really. I mean, he was tomcatting around a lot back then. He was he sang in a band. He rode a motorcycle. You know, he knew martial arts. He was very confident. He was the bad boy that some girls like, you know. Hmm. And he was, you know, I think he would admit at that point he was a man of bad character. You wouldn't want your daughter dating him. But, you know, bad character shouldn't get you convicted for life, particularly when
That's
you
right.
didn't commit the murder.
Right. And just imagine how much of a tomcat he would have been if you'd had those Chuck Norris action genes, right?
That's right. At 56, he's a much different man, you know.
Now, Colin, I do think you're probably going to be going into this in a future episode, but you did hint, you dropped one line in episode two that stuck out to me, so I'm going to ask you about it. The potential motive, the reason why the police centered in on Fred, was it because the victim, Scott Macklem, was dating an ex-girlfriend of his?
Correct, yeah, and we will cover this in more detail, but in effect, Crystal Merrill had dated Fred Freeman over the summer, several months before this murder. And then she was, at the time of Scott Macklem's death, dating Scott Macklem. And right, the theory that they create using Crystal Merrill's testimony is that essentially Fred Freeman was devastated when she broke up with him and was in a rage. And this is sort of the motive for this murder. And that's, as we'll see, conflicted by other witnesses in the case. But that's essentially the state's theory of the murder and the motive.
Which hardly makes sense because he had so many girlfriends. He wasn't.
Exactly.
It was kind of the other way around, I would say. I think Crystal was a woman scorned, and she was trying to settle that a little bit in how she testified at trial and so forth regarding his character.
As far as focusing in on Fred Freeman, that there was definitely what appears to be tunnel vision focusing on Fred Freeman, but that was by the detective in charge of the case, who was a sergeant. And the other detective involved in this case was Detective Harry Hudson. And Harry, I met with and talked to him with for a couple hours about this case. And Harry was a good man. He would never want to see an innocent person go to prison for something the person didn't do. But the problem was that Harry Hudson wasn't in charge of this case. It was his supervisor. I put most of the blame on Bob Cleland with this.
And just to note, Bob Cleland is the prosecutor in this case, and we'll be talking about him in more detail in episode 3.
Who's now a federal judge, by the way.
Oh, he's a judge now.
Yep.
He's a federal judge.
Oh, wonderful.
Here in Port Huron, he was the elected prosecutor, and he ran for attorney general here in Michigan and lost the election right the day before that Scott Macklem was murdered. But Bob Cleland never even became a district court judge. He just jumped right from prosecutor to a federal judge.
And it was a high-profile murder in his community by a Republican support of the mayor. The mayor of Croswell was the father of the victim, Scott Macklem. And he was a supporter of Robert Cleland as well. And Cleland needed a quick conviction to look good for his career, which was ambitious because, as I said, he was appointed to a federal judge. And, you know, I think a lot of it surrounds this conviction, as Herb says, surrounds what the prosecutor did, because you just mentioned Freeman had such a solid alibi, you know, and that's what astounds people. They say, with such a solid alibi, how would he ever have been convicted? And what I like to say, not being a lawyer, but what I like to say is that the way he got that conviction in major part was that he invented evidence.
Yeah.
He invented, in effect, a jailhouse snitch, Phil Joplin, who would lie and say that Freeman confessed to him spontaneously in a holding cell. You know, and for that false testimony, this Joplin, who was a six-time felon, you know, he got a significant favor. He wasn't sent back to prison, but he was then housed in a community setting in Port Huron. And of course, he's later recanted on videotape, saying he was given those favors. And also, he wanted to back out of that testimony before trial, but he was threatened if he did so, bad things would happen. And the other piece of invented evidence, which has been mentioned, is this phantom chartered airplane flight from Escanaba to Huron and back in the middle of the night, you know, with not a scintilla of evidence that's happened. And I think especially those two pieces of invented evidence allow the jury to somehow look past a solid alibi.
Yes. I mean, I think that the airplane theory is one of the most bananas thing I've ever heard in any of these cases. You know, Anne actually wrote on Twitter, a private plane to do a murder and then go to a karate class? Come on, where did the prosecutor make this stuff up from? I can't imagine. I mean, the sort of root talk thing that, you know, Sarah Koenig first did in Serial, trying to, you know, see whether or not Adnan Syed could have gone to all these different places. And, you know, I think that there's some broad agreement, especially probably among the disclosed crew, that there was probably some fudging of that root talk in that, just for the sake of, you know, it's possible, very unlikely, but possible. This is not possible. This guy was poor. He was poor. Now, I mean, take the time, even if you take the time out of it, he was poor. Like, a poor person does not charter a plane to fly somewhere. That's the thing that stuck out to me the most. The time stuff obviously made no sense, but it's like, it's just not something a poor person can do, right?
Right.
Right. As far as the airplane theory, so this morning I again reviewed the testimony at trial, and the airplane pilot, and probably, Colin, you'll be using this maybe in the next segment, is my interview of Detective Harry Hudson. When I met with him, I had no idea who Bob Evans was, the airplane pilot. And when I'm talking to Harry about this case, he said to me, "Herb, well, you know who the airplane pilot, Bob Evans, is, right?" And I said, "No, I have no idea who he is." And he said, "Well, that was Bob Cleland's personal airplane pilot."
Oh.
And when he was running for attorney general here in Michigan in 1986, that Bob Evans was his pilot who would take him to the speaking engagements throughout Michigan. So, yes, I don't know, Colin, but you'll probably be using that. But anyways, so I looked over the testimony this morning from Bob Evans as far as expense, you know, how much it would cost. And Bob Evans was asked, "How much would you charge the taxpayers to take these detectives up there?" And he answered, "In the single, it's $320. And one time in the twin, it was $380, which is my expense." So then Bob Evans is asked later about the cost. And he said, "It's by mileage, and different planes carry a different price per mile. But a single engine retractable would be about $450. A larger twin for a charter service would be $650 to $750, depending how large a plane you take." And that was from Escanaba to Port Huron.
Yeah.
And then in his closing statement to the court, Bob Cleland told the jury about how much it would cost, and he said to the jury, "The point of the testimony this morning, with 23 airstrips in airports, an hour and a half travel time by plane, and a couple of $100 out-of-pocket expenses, the point is that everyone in this case could be telling the truth and remembering accurately, and it does not provide an alibi for Frederick Freeman."
Yeah, that's wrong. It's just not true. I mean, this is like one of those cases that sometimes you hear stuff and it's like, you know, I think about like the Joey Watkins case, which I know there's been development and I'm going to ask you about that, Colin. But like, you know, that's one of those more squishy, like maybe could be, you know, depends who you talk to kind of situation. This is not that. This is not that. And this, you know, I think the deus ex machina analogy was so apt, because to think that a jury would be told this story and then for, you know, it must have been done very well because they convicted him. I don't know. It's just clearly just not true. And I'm comfortable saying that, even though I don't typically like speculating, it is just clearly not true. Colin, it's not true, right? I mean, you don't like speculating either.
There's the other part of it, which is, okay, obviously it's beyond his financial means. There's no evidence to support him taking this private plane. But beyond that, you know, the state's overall theory is that Frederick Freeman is a criminal mastermind who has this well-plotted out thing. I'm going to charter a private plane, drive down, be back just in time to go to the karate studio. But he's going to take the plane, drive to a crowded community college parking lot, and then, in the view of possibly hundreds of students, shoot the victim with a shotgun. Like,
right.
how does that make sense? If you're going to do this whole well-plotted scheme to create your alibi, you're going to kill him in a private location, out-of-the-way place, not in a crowded community parking lot with a shotgun.
But he was a ninja, Colin. He was a ninja.
Plus, where are the conspirators he would need that would provide him with the vehicle, you know,
right,
to get there and back? Right?
How would he know the guy was going to be there? Like, did he have, you know, did he have a tracker on him?
And how would he know that the victim, Scott, would be at the that exact location at the right time. So
exactly.
He could commit the murder. You know, he would have no way of knowing that, except that, I guess, as Crystal said at trial, he's some sort of magical ninja with supernatural powers. And by the way, a secret organization supporting him. And that's how, yeah. That's how he did it.
I actually do want to ask about that because, you know, it sounds nuts now. However, Colin, I think you can probably underscore this. You know, in the 80s, especially, there were a lot of wrongful convictions and weird prosecutions and sort of, you know, based on people's perceptions of like pop culture stuff, right? I think about, you know, the West Memphis Three and the whole all the satanic panic stuff and people bringing into court, like, listen to this piece of music that these kids listen to, or like, watch this movie that people watch. Like, the karate thing did actually play into this mystique that they built around Freeman, right? And it was so funny to hear the karate studio owner, John Minali, talk about the exact films that those tropes were pulled from that then were used against him. Like, that really did happen here, right, Colin?
Yeah, and we'll focus more on Crystal Merrill and her testimony at trial. There's a point at trial where she's testifying about what either Dave or Herb just mentioned about him being a member of this secret organization, being a ninja. And at one point, you can see in the transcript that Fred asked his attorney to ask a question. Isn't it true that this story you're coming up with comes from this specific movie we saw? And it's from the movie, not actually from anything in real life. But yeah, I was thinking, Rebecca, the same thing as you, the whole satanic panic where the people were watching these baby sacrifices and drinking blood in the 80s, and this became a real thing. It's similar to that. And yeah, I mean, ninjas and karate, taekwondo were all big things in the 80s. And I could see, and obviously it happened, this jury sort of buying it in some way. And that's what they had to do because the evidence, as it actually existed, did not support a theory of guilt.
Now, Colin, did you want to acknowledge the one correction you got via email about some sort of airport distance discrepancy?
Yeah, when I was plugging in the location between the airport, the St. Clair County Airport and the St. Clair County Community College, I, for some reason in Google Maps, pulled up the community college, a branch location and not the central one. So that is more of a 15-minute drive instead of a 50-minute drive. And so if you're going with that theory of chartering the private plane and flying in, it would take less time to drive to the community college campus. And so, yes, that is
assuming the
correction
car was sitting right next
yes,
to the plane.
Assuming
waiting
the car's
for
there. But there's the other part. And I think Herb and Dave, especially Herb, might be able to comment on this, that the other comment, which I think is important to note about the speed limit on these roads back in 1986 versus today.
So you could drive faster, but, you know, if you're talking about driving the whole way, which is really ridiculous in the winter on a dark night, trying to drive so fast that you could get there and back, it's just not feasible.
Yeah. And so on that front, I was also, you know, in 2020, me doing Google Maps and it gave 6.5 hours. And the comment we got was on Facebook from someone named Bill Collin, who said, you know, now the speed limits are between 70 and 75 miles per hour for about 2/3 of the trip, whereas the speed limit on Michigan interstate highways in 1986 was 55 miles per hour. And that's what Dave was just mentioning there. And also keep in mind, if he is driving, certainly after the murder, you don't want to speed too much, because if you're pulled over, that would, of course, destroy the whole alibi that the state is saying he's trying to create.
But Colin, none of that matters because this isn't what happened. I'm incredibly comfortable saying none of that matters because this is not what happened. One thing I just want to point out, I mean, I think geographically it's important people to understand this. I live in a very small state. You can drive from the top to the bottom of my state in like 4.5 hours or whatever. And you can drive from both sides of it in like 2.5 hours. I'm probably not getting that exactly right, but you get the gist. Michigan is not a small state. And, you know, the sort of the idea that there's a peninsula, like the Upper Peninsula, Lower Peninsula, they're very far apart. And I think that's important people to understand, right?
Right.
Sure.
It's a vast amount of mileage.
Yeah. And I was going to look through the testimony because I couldn't remember if that was talked about the speed limit back then. But and I was curious too if it was 55 miles an hour in 1986. You know, I can't remember that in the testimony.
Yeah. One of the other things that stuck out to me was the hypnosis of one of the witnesses by his own professor. Why did he think that was a good idea to hypnotize his student? We actually got a note from somebody who says that Stephen Lynn was actually her professor in her doctoral program, and she worked for a semester in his hypnosis lab. You did talk to this hypnosis expert, Stephen Lynn, Colin, and he said this is like one of the worst uses of this that he's ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, and it's in important ways, as we said in the episode. I mean, it's essential that we have Gobian saying that this suspect has a beard. That does not come from him. It comes from Mooney. He suggests that in the first place. The make and model of the vehicle. We have the student coming in convinced it's a foreign vehicle, maybe a Mazda. And it's Mooney who says, is this a Ford? Is it a Chevy? And he leaves thinking this is a Ford Escort. So, I mean, you can just literally, from looking at this transcript, see how his testimony changes from police statement to his eventual testimony at trial.
And, you know, and I think you also have to view it in the context of a small town where a lot of people knew each other. You know, we had a college student, this Rennie Goldman, who knew several police officers, wanted to be a police officer, and he wanted to be helpful to this murder investigation. And then you had a professor, Dr. Mooney, who knew several officers as well and wanted to be helpful. So the thing is, Dr. Mooney never had done hypnosis before, and he, as Colin said, asked leading questions and the like to try and get a more detailed description of the suspect, which, you know, was faulty. So I'd say if Freeman had a credible defense attorney who wasn't cocaine addicted and at its very worst in terms of cocaine addiction at the time of the trial, that I don't know that testimony would have made it into court, or at least it would have been strongly objected to, you'd think.
I just wanted to mention he seems very enamored with law enforcement and wants to surround himself with police officers. Yeah, he would go on skiing trips, he told me, with different officers that I worked with. But when I interviewed him recently, you know, I was one of his students in college, and he even told me where I was sitting in the classroom, and I was only a cadet at that time.
Wow.
So he really has a thing about police officers. And he taught, you know, when I interviewed him, he was telling me the names of all these officers that have been in his class. And, oh, John Bounds, you probably haven't seen that one, but that was the detective in charge of this case, Sergeant John Bounds. And he said, you know, and all the students that I ever taught over the years, Herb, the one that stood out was John Bounds sitting in the front row of the Playboy magazine looking at the picture in class.
That's some very, like, community college stereotyping right there. I'm not sure I like that, but so we did get a tweet from Richard Plunkett, who says, you can't trust an eyewitness who identifies someone from that far away. Now, this is an evidentiary point that has been covered in other undisclosed cases, both in terms of cross-racial identification and distance identification. So, Herb, can you talk a little bit about the different parking lots mentioned in this case and how that would have affected the distance of this identification from Richard Krueger?
Well, the murder happened in the student parking lot over by River Street and McMoran, over in that area by the College Center. And according to the testimony of Richard Krueger, he was over at the McMoran parking lot. And that would have been just approximately 1,300 feet from the scene of the murder. Now, one thing I wanted to mention about that is that in Richard Krueger's testimony, he talked about a parking lot attendant who was nearby when he was observing this suspicious person over by in the McMoran parking lot. That there was a parking lot attendant nearby, and that's true. In that parking lot, there's a booth there, and at that time, that booth would have had a person in it. So that could have been a very important witness to be interviewed if they saw this person acting suspiciously also in that area, but that person was never identified or interviewed.
Yeah, and so also keep in mind that Krueger in the suspect lineup did not pick Freeman. He picked another guy called James Longston.
Exactly. Exactly. And this whole, the way that the lineup was done, the way the array was done. Colin, can you just briefly remind us how messed up that was and why?
Yeah, well, I mean, you have these four other photos, two different photos of four other people in the array, and then Fred Freeman. And, you know, Fred Freeman has, like the others, one photo facing forward, but his other photo, he's faced in the opposite direction of the other individuals in the photo array. He has those lines that you see for suspects behind him. The other individuals do not. He has a different police department placard under his photo than the other four individuals. So there's just all these differences. And yeah, this expert, Jennifer Dysart, comes in and looks at it. You know, we had before Dr. Lin saying this is essentially the worst example of hypnosis I've ever seen. And now you have this other expert, Jennifer Dysart, coming in and saying this is the worst, most suggestive photo array I've ever seen. And the jurors were misled. They were shown different photos than the ones that were given to the eyewitnesses to see. And of course, as we noted in the episode, Herb was there to uncover this original photo array that was shown to the eyewitnesses.
It's also important that that Pleasant Ridge placard that was only on Fred was important because the newspaper at the time had an article that suggested that the killer was not local.
So how is this not a slam dunk for ineffective assistance of counsel? That's what Liz wants to know. She wrote in, she said all this crazy evidence, mishandling of evidence, improper hypnosis, crazy lineups. How is it not a slam dunk for an easy overturning of this conviction? I'd love to give you all a chance to sort of respond to that. What do you think, Herb? Why isn't this a slam dunk?
Because the prosecutor, again, is a very intelligent man and well-spoken, and during his closing argument, one of the things that he talked about was the alleged character of Fred Freeman. And I've gone through his closing statement, and things that the prosecutor said about Fred Freeman was that he was a skilled warrior, that he fancied himself as a ninja, that he used ninja killing techniques, and that he would jump out of buildings and take people by surprise. Now, how did Fred Freeman get convicted? I believe that it was, a lot of it was based upon the testimony of Rennie Gobian, as identifying Fred Freeman as the driver of that car seen leaving the area. And during the closing statement, Bob Cleland said that all three of those witnesses in the college parking lot saw the vehicle that was driven allegedly by Fred Freeman back out of a parking space from where it was next to Scott Macklem's vehicle, and then travel north through the parking lot. But that's not true. None of the three ever saw, in their testimony, all three of them said they never saw the vehicle back up and then go north through the parking lot. But during his closing statement, that's what he told the jury. How did Fred Freeman get convicted? Another thing is the testimony of Phil Joplin, who now, after trial, we have documentation showing that a deal was given to him so that he wouldn't have to go back to prison in exchange for his testimony. How did Fred Freeman get convicted? The testimony as to Fred Freeman's involvement in martial arts. I think that played a big part of it, because at one point, his own attorney, David Dean, said, hey, I thought that the murder weapon was a shotgun. But the prosecutor was allowed to keep going on and on about this martial arts stuff and the weapons involved. And then the airplane theory. and to overcome the alibi witnesses. The prosecutor admitted in his closing argument that he didn't know himself what the motive was. But yeah, Bob Cleland talks about he doesn't know what the motive was. And as far as lack of evidence, no physical evidence was ever obtained linking Fred Freeman to this murder. Fred Freeman had never been seen in a car like the one that was seen driving away from the area where Scott Macklin was killed that morning. Crystal Merrill testified that she never saw Fred Freeman and Scott Macklin talk to each other. She stated that she only knows for sure that they saw each other once on one occasion, maybe twice, but they never talked to each other. And it was Crystal Merrill at testimony at trial said that she broke it off with Fred, the dating, and he told her, well, that's no skin off of my back.
I might say it is astounding that Freeman didn't win on having an incompetent attorney. That is really astounding. And, you know, I don't know, Colin, if you've looked at the Randy Overton case, I think it's in part of the materials we sent you. Randy Overton took Dean to court on that very issue, that is, his lawyering for him was incompetent. And he won. And he won on the fact that Dean was, among other things, cocaine addicted at the time. And in that testimony at that Overton trial or hearing, Jan Barnum, who was Dean's assistant, testified that Dean was at his very worst in terms of cocaine addiction at the time of Freeman's trial. So, you know, it's just amazing he didn't win on that case. But wrongful convictions are often this way. They lose in court all the time, which is why we're essentially at having the state conviction integrity unit examine his case. And we're hopeful that if that happens, you know, he will eventually be free. That's about his only opportunity right now is through that conviction integrity unit. And overlaying all this, obviously, is COVID-19, which is running through his prison. He's very susceptible to that with his health issues. And the Michigan Innocence Clinic has submitted an emergency clemency application based upon COVID-19, but the governor has not acted, and it's incredibly frustrating.
I knew David, of course, real well, and he was a very good attorney, and I know Fred wouldn't like me saying this, but I think he did a decent job representing him. He could have done better. I'm sure that if he wouldn't have been under the influence of cocaine or whatever, that he would have done better, but you know, I can't put a lot of blame on David Dean, but it's true that he was a cocaine addict, so.
Well, Herb and Dave, I can't thank you enough for filling me in on the particulars of this case. It's such a pleasure to talk to people who are so intimate with all the details, and you provided a lot of insights, and I'm really looking forward to the things that you've talked about that I know Colin is going to be including in future episodes. So, Dave and Herb, thank you so much.
Thank you. We enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks for all you're doing. We sure appreciate it.
So, Colin, one quick question for you, but before I let you go, we did get a quick question from a listener looking for an update on the Joey Watkins case. I did see that there had been some news in that case. Can you just fill us in briefly on what's going on with that case?
Yeah, and these two cases are at least somewhat connected. Harold Kopis, who you might recall was part of our Joey Watkins case, he's a former FBI agent, worked on Joey's case and has also worked over the years on the Frederick Freeman case, as we'll discuss later. And so as you might recall, back in November of 2019, there were oral arguments in the Joey Watkins case. And a few weeks ago, we got the ruling from the Supreme Court of Georgia that Joey's appeal can go forward. Both his claim that there was juror misconduct by driving the route from a cell tower ping to the scene of the murder, as well as the claim of a Brady violation based upon failing to disclose evidence connected to Isaac Dawkins, the victim's dog. And so with COVID-19, it's unclear when the case will move forward. But yes, both of those claims were found to be viable. And we think that there's a strong compelling argument that Joy Watkins should be granted a new trial in fairly short order.
And that's extraordinary, because I remember when that podcast season ended, there really wasn't anything that we could hope for at times. That's extraordinary. So really, congratulations on your team and the legal team and everybody who's working on this for bringing this case to the forefront. And I know that I've been curious about it, too. So that's very exciting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Colin, I can't wait to hear the upcoming episodes of this Fred Freeman case. It has been completely bananas and super fun to edit and listen to and jaw-dropping. And I can't wait to hear the next two episodes. Thank you so much for talking to me about it.
All right, thank you.
And if you have questions about this case or any of the other cases covered on Undisclosed, you can just ask them on social media. Just look for Undisclosed Pod on all the platforms. Production for The Addendum is by Hannah McCarthy. And if you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime review podcast, Crime Writers On. Thanks so much to executive producer Methil Telhan and to Colin, Rabia, and Susan for continuing to let me be a part of their work. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening, and there's more to come next week.